This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Well, first off, compañeras y compañeros de la lucha y de la lucha académica, good evening, everyone. First off, thank you to everyone who showed up today. I know it's week one. Early in the quarter, and it's a little bit later, so I really appreciate everyone being here to watch a very important kind of a film series, right? Before we begin the conversation, I just wanted to thank and express my gratitude towards the Carsey Wolf Center for hosting us and obviously letting us use this incredible space. To the student workers who are filming this right now, right? Definitely wanted to give a shout out to them and their labor and their time and energy. And I also wanted to thank the ancestral authorities of the Ishil region, right? So a lot of the folks who are featured in the film. And lastly, of course, Dr. Alejandro Flores. I'm sure there's different like ethical consideration one needs to take as a filmmaker, as a researcher, given the sensitive nature of the stories that were told here, right? There's stories of violence, different forms of violence, genocide, massacres that happened to a lot of Ishilas of their loved ones, right? So. I guess the first question I had for you, Alejandro, was, you know, given kind of these very sensitive stories, I think you were able to weave these in a very beautiful way. Having done research myself in the Ishil region, I know that could be quite a challenge. So could you speak a little bit about the methodology and I guess the process of doing this type of work? I guess a lot of people may have questions in terms of like, how did the project begin, right? Mm-hmm. How did the conversations look like between you and the Ishil University and the ancestral authorities? Who at the beginning of the film, if y'all noticed, they're the ones that officially present this work. And how did your positionality play into the conversations that you had with them, right? Some of these questions come from, you know, as researchers, we have to be careful in terms of academic extractivism, right? In terms of like going into, especially indigenous communities and doing research there. The Ishilas have this concept of, they have this critique against academics and anthropologists. Solo vienen, sacan información y se van, right? So ethnographers and other academics come to communities, especially indigenous ones, oppressed communities. They do research, they take out information, and then they leave, right? So I guess that's where some of these questions and concerns that a lot of us in this room may have that we want to ask you, right? So kind of just picking your brain in terms of how did this project come about?
Yeah, okay. It's a long story. I think it begins in 2015. That was my first year doing field work for my PhD. I was working at kind of a different topic for the dissertation. However, I have to thank you for this and also the authorities of the Ishil University and the ancestral authorities because you made this first connection with them. I have spoken a couple of years before with the rector of the Ishil University, but actually that was after that invitation you did in 2015, that there was going to be an examination process for the Ishil students that were finishing their Técnico en Desarrollo Rural. This is some kind of like a mid-grade university Ishil degree. And one of the things that they do at the Ishil University, at this level, is that they carry out also research processes. And one of the goals of the Ishil University in this regard is trying to find some ways to not necessarily recover, but somehow reconstruct a lot of the things that were destroyed during the war. We're not talking here only about concrete things, but also cultural things that actually the military was targeting in the late 70s and early 90s. But also they try to find development alternatives, and there, Giovanni can probably explain you guys better how the Ishil University worked because he delved in the work there for a couple of years, and he knows very well also about that. But the thing is that in that moment, I was invited as an examiner. I was having this role of hearing the works of the Ishil students and we had like a small group of people that were doing the same. But at some point, it drew my attention that was like in terms of historical perspective, there was always references by the students who always talk about colonialism, and then they talk about genocide. But there was like this big gap between, I don't know, the end of the 18th or early 19th century and what was happening in the 1980s. And actually, it was kind of interesting, but also it was like a, something that I was talking with the rector of the Universidad de Chile, Pablo Seto. And we were like, okay, but what happened, I mean, during the 20th century? Because it was like the colonial time. I mean, of course, we had the first invasion. Giovanni wrote a book about that. That happened in the 16th century. But then we have like something that we could eventually call like the Pax Colonial, you know, like the Ischia region was a very remote place. And not necessarily, I mean, the colonialists weren't that interested in the Ischia region during this centuries that colonialism during the state in Guatemala. It wasn't until the end of the 19th century, actually, that you know, this new capitalist elite directed their attention towards the Ischia region, because the production model changed completely. Before, I mean, Guatemala, I mean, had a role in the global economy by exporting things that didn't need actually like large amounts of land or large amounts of labor, but it was with the introduction of the coffee plantation, you know, because it wasn't until the 19th century that coffee became a thing worldwide speaking. That Guatemala was like the perfect place for you know, producing coffee, and in the late 19th century, that happened this thing that is called the Revolution Liberal, the Liberal Revolution. And what these liberals were thinking is that, okay, probably the coffee could be like some sort of propellant of development for the country, so that the country could enter into capitalism. This is something we speak a little bit about that in the beginning of the movie. And that had a lot of consequences, because for producing coffee, you need a lot of land on the one hand, and you need a lot of labor. So it changed everything, because before, I mean, land and labor wasn't necessarily like a big thing. And one of the consequences, for instance, in places like the Ischia region, is that a lot of community land was expropriated. Giovanni actually has also, I mean, I'm always quoting Giovanni because I am drawing on his work. You see how all these processes of expropriation of communitarian that happened, I mean, like in a period of 25, 30 years. And all of these processes were, I mean, very unfair on the one hand, but it happened in a very, like, shady way. I mean, nobody was like really sure what was happening, and suddenly forests or places were traditionally used by indigenous communities for, I don't know, you know, like getting wood or hunting or stuff like that became private property. So that was an interesting thing, because when we were talking with the rector of the Universidad de Chile, it was like, okay, but actually, like the real usurpation of Ischia territory and Ischia land happened in the 19th century. So it's kind of important that we develop some kind of work, so that it's not only like these two milestones, not milestones, like these two moments in history, like colonial moment and the moment of the genocide in the 1980s, and that we try to create like a broader context in the curriculum of the Ischia University. So that was when we decided to start developing history classes. But the whole point, I mean, in this process was, okay, we're not going to necessarily teach like the canon of history that is being produced in official universities. In Guatemala, we need to find methodologies so that the history of Guatemala can be somehow placed, can be somehow located or situated in the region. I mean, not only to say, okay, you know, this happened in the country, and it's like very flattening in the end, because you have like these historical perspectives that tell you the story of the country, but suddenly you lose like a resolution, you lose grain, you know, with this like broader perspective. So the idea was, okay, how can we work with the broader like historical canonic discourse, but how can we situate that broader perspective in the Asia region? So what we did is that we developed a methodology where it was I and another colleague, Juan Carlos Mazariegos, and Gio was helping also as well, and other people also, Tobias, and also was Otto Cuellar and other people. But the thing was that we came to the Ishil University every second week, and we prepared like short lectures of like the canon in historic discourse. And then we worked all together in order to find ways so that the students could go back to their communities and do their own research. This is not something that sounds very good now after the COVID pandemic, but the idea was that they were going to do their own research with their communities, and they were going to try to understand how each of these historical moments, these historical periods, were experienced in place. And that was like the first phase, and some of the photographs that you actually saw are the result of that first phase of research, because what we did in the end is that we were discussing, okay, what are we going to do with this material or the research findings that you had? And we said, okay, we can write something like very synthetic, but the thing is that, as they say, you know, like a lot of people actually don't know how to read in the Asian region. So like the writing register is not necessarily the best register. So we started to have these conversations of using other kind of probably visual resources in order to facilitate the socialization, the dissemination of the research findings. And we ended up making a series of, it was like, I don't remember very well, but I think it was like 42 photographic reenactments of the research findings. So that was some of the photographs we had the chance to see here are the result of that process. After that moment finished, it was another interesting conversation, because we had all this transitional justice, you know, like all the human rights trials going on that was very, very focusing on the issue region. And one of the things that were kind of troubling, I mean, we were discussing with the authorities of the Ishil University, was that kind of the general representation of the region was mediated by human rights and courts and transitional justice. So there is this thing that is very obvious, that when you're making like a human rights case, you need to create certain kind of discourse, you know? But this kind of discourse implies sometimes that there are some things that the lawyers and people taking place in these processes are not necessarily willing to show, because they are not going to help their cases. And one of those things were the politicization of the Ishil region. And a lot of the, I mean, almost everybody, at least in the ancestral authorities and also in the Universidad de Ishil, were very active politically during the 1970s and the 1980s. And a lot of them also rose up in arms. I mean, they became part of the revolutionary movement. But one of the things that they were always like highlighting was that it wasn't necessarily only like they incorporated in something that was coming from the capital city, but that there was already like a resistance process taking place since the 1930s. This is why we mentioned like shortly the execution of the Siete Principales in 1936, because what that shows is that they were already like resisting, and somehow that execution of the Seven Principales in 1936 was considered as an act of war in the region, because we are thinking about that the state killed local authorities that at that time like had like a lot of recognition, you know, by the communities, and they were political authorities. So it is like if we make some, you know, very probably dumb analogy, like if we imagine the Mexican president coming here into the United States or sending some military to kill people in the Congress or in the Senate. So we can't even imagine that. It's like a, such a big aggression. I mean, if we put it in those terms that we cannot think about, but when we situate that that event in 1936, for the Ixiles, at least for a lot of Ixiles, it was a transgression that never was discussed. I mean, and it doesn't even appear in any history book or anything. So it's something that is always like inhabiting memory, and is something that is very relevant for them. So what they were saying is that, okay, we were like rising up in arms in the 1980s and 1970s, but before, for instance, we took part of this Acción Católica and other things that were going on in the 60s, where these development projects came with the Teología de la Liberación, the liberation theology, but also the creation of all these cooperatives, but also there were all these remnants that were created during the 10 years of democratic spring, as they call it in Guatemala, with an agrarian reform took place. And one of the things that the agrarian reform created was a thing that was called the Comités Campesinos Locales. And the Comités Campesinos Locales, or local agrarian committees, were composed mostly by locals in different places, most of them indigenous peoples, that were like finding lands that were usurpated, that were expropriated in the 19th century for these fincas, and there were what we call tierras ociosas, you know, lands that weren't being used. So the agrarian reform, the Decreto 900, 900 decree, opened the possibility for the communities to recover those lands. But in 54, we had like a counter-revolution, we have a coup d'etat, a putsch, and all these agrarian reform initiatives were killed, but the organization seed kept. So people was still organizing, even though you didn't have any more the support of the state. The people that started organizing in the 50s still work, you know, like trying to strategize always how to find ways to recover territory, indigenous territories. So the discourse that we actually find in the Ixchel region is that they are always saying, okay, what happened during the 1970s was only a moment, you know, like when we rose up in arms was only a moment in a long process of resistance, rebellion. And in that moment, it implied to declare war. But what they say sometimes also is that war was already like installed in the territory since late 19th century, and specifically after the massacre of the Siete Principales in 1936. Mm-hmm. So that drove us into saying, okay, let's try to make some life stories with former ex-combatants, guerrilla ex-combatants, and people who lived in the resistance. The Ceperos were communities that escaped when the violence came, and they lived like in a very nomadic way, like for 15 years in these hills, always running from the military, but that had a very close relationship with the guerrillas. So the idea was, okay, we're going to develop this research process, and we designed a new class that intended to make some sort of encounter between like oral history and memory, like methods, I mean, things that we can probably learn here in the university, but also we explored other methodologies. And this is actually because somebody was asking about the first episode of this series. The first episode of this series is only about methods. It's only about how the research process took place and how this like encounter of different ways of producing knowledge took place. And they focus a lot on this concept that they call the Kelum. The Kelum is like a way of producing knowledge while people are also like helping, for instance, the elderly working in the crops, in the cornfields and everything. And that's the moment when the knowledge comes out. So probably we can have another conversation about that. But the thing is that was the moment when we decided doing that. And we gathered a total of 19 life stories. That was in 2016. Mm-hmm. And then we edit them. That was a long process back in the day. We didn't have all these fantastic artificial intelligence tools that make a lot of... Johnny hates artificial intelligence, but helps a lot. You know, like if we had those tools back in the day, probably the work that took us 3 years could have been done in a month. Mm-hmm. We had to work like 3 years doing the editing because I had to work also. I was working at Landivar University, so I only had like my free time for working on that. And in the end, we published a book. But it wasn't like the traditional like editorial book. It was like a community-based, community-crafted book. We only printed 22 copies. Each one of the copies was delivered to each one of the interviewees. And then at that moment, I was, I wrote the grant for the Werner Grün, the FEJOS postdoctoral fellowship, and I got it. So I had like time, like for a year for doing the interviews. So the idea was that we were going to return the interviews. We discussed, okay, but we're going to record the video now. We're going to make a series, with the same spirit that the written register is not necessarily the best, so that the Yeshil University can use these interviews to make them part of their curriculum. Mm-hmm. So that's how the project is created, and this is why this is the second episode. We're going to have other things. Yeah. So.
No, and I think one of the things that I really appreciate about these interviews is, people there in some of these interviews, I'm assuming took like an hour, 2 hours, and the way that people tell their stories are very nuanced in the way that they storytell in different communities and things like that. So then I really appreciate how you were able to kind of weave these different stories and kind of make it fit in a way that was very, I think it was really rich in different types of histories from different perspectives and voices. I also appreciated how the voices came out as in a very dignified way. I always have this expression in Espanol, es como el sistema te humilla, right? So the system always tries to humiliate you. And I guess the next question that I had for you was like, how does this film, right? Why was it important? In terms of the description, you say that it was important to kind of interview former guerrilleros, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you could talk a little bit more about mm-hmm. who's doing the talking, because of course this is episode 2. Maybe in episode 1 you talk about who's actually doing the talking. Mm-hmm. Again, I think it's important to kind of share that. And then I guess the second part of that question, for some of y'all, this is the first time this film is actually being shared, right, in the public space. So what are the next steps? Is this film going to be showed in the communities? How are y'all thinking that mm-hmm. with the ancestral authorities, for instance?
Yeah, regarding your first question, why guerrilleros? That's precisely the thing. It's like how can we talk about realities that have been really violent, that have produced a lot of victimhood, if we can call it like that. But how can we see that there are a lot of other things happening? And that, what we can see in these interviews is that there are life stories of, for instance, Shun, guy, he has to work in a coffee plant, in the sugar cane plantations since he was 7, yeah? So it's kind of a very harsh story. But then you have stories like the one from Tekchi, for instance, from Mekabil. They didn't have that experience. Like they worked when they were children, but it was more like the community process. It was almost like a part of a pedagogic process of becoming a member of the Yeshil community. So what we can see precisely is that there is a lot of nuance there. And one of the things that we were trying to do with this project was to bring this nuance into the public debate eventually, because we're going to talk about that later, but the political situation in this moment in Guatemala is super complicated, and I don't know how possible this is now. But back in the day, the things was were different. But the idea was, okay, to say, okay, there is a lot of nuance here. I mean, there is like an historical context, there is collective memory, but there are different realities. It's like not every issue experienced the same life story. And even though that was like that, we see that a lot of them rose up in arms. So that's kind of interesting. It's because we don't have like an over-deterministic explanation, you know, like a theory. Okay, it was because of class. It was because you see, like there is like a lot of things that triggered people eventually to take the decision and to say, okay, I'm to become a guerrillero. Some of them, like Shun, for instance, he was like really pissed because the experiences he had in the finca, the same as Miguel, you know, like he always says that the moment that that the overseer kicked him is the moment when he said, nope, I don't want to do this anymore. So, but on the other hand, you have these other guys who were taking part of Acción Católica, and the military repressed them. So the only chance they had was to either to be under the control and eventually being disappeared or killed by the military, or go and either be in the CPR or become combatants, guerrilla combatants. So that's the thing. There is other people. I mean, some of I think it was Sid. She tells a little bit of her story, which is really, really terrible. But she says, yeah, I mean, I wanted to go because the military was very cruel and they killed my family. So I took this side, you know. So we have a lot of different experiences that actually converge in that moment. And one of the interesting things is that there is also like a local theory about that. They call it el encuentro de los ríos, like the river encounter. You have heard about that. It's like they say it's not only one thing. There were all these like struggle processes that at that specific moment in history, probably because of chance, I don't know, but created the possibility of making an articulation that ended up in an indigenous uprising in places like the Ishil region, or for instance in Huehuetenango. Or in Chimaltenango, which are the places where we can see that was like a strong indigenous participation in the war.
Yeah. No, doing research or living in Guatemala, and I don't know, maybe I have my parents are from Guatemala, so I always feel like I have this fatalistic, optimistic outlook on life, like it can't get worse than this. You know, in some of these stories, you know, it's just, it can be pretty grim. But again, these stories come from the war. For those of y'all who don't know, Guatemala had a civil armed conflict from 1960 to 1996. 200,000 people died. There was a genocide. That's what we label the third invasion. The fourth invasion, some researchers in Avanzo, some Guatemalan researchers call it the period and era of the undeclared extractivist war, right? So even though there was peace declared in 1996, the violence continues in different ways. Yesterday was the 11th year anniversary of the first known state-sponsored massacre against indigenous peoples in Totonicapán, right? So again, the violence hasn't ended. But a lot of youth don't see a future in Guatemala, right? So they're willing to risk their lives knowing the potential violence that may come upon them because there's no other option, right? So again, as you can see here, it's kind of a contradiction. You see the beautiful landscape that Alejandro was able to capture. Guatemala tends to be very photogenic in that way. But again, it's a land that's seen a lot of violence, and the violence hasn't ended, right? So I don't know if you could kind of provide a quick update, kind of briefly, before we open it up to the audience. What's going on in Guatemala today? Because we know today is actually the fourth day de un paro nacional, like a national strike. So a lot of the colleagues, compañeros who come out in this film right now, they're literally on the streets right now fighting for a better tomorrow, right? To live a dignified life against a system que nos humilla, that humiliate us, right? That treat us in a very subhuman way. So again, I don't know if you could kind of briefly just kind of let folks know what's going on. You know, you had mentioned before the film started that please don't take films because there might be some security concerns and things like that. So again, that's kind of the era we're in right now, right? Mm-hmm. Where a lot of these stories, potentially cause some harm for a lot of the people you interviewed. So I don't know if you could just kind of briefly share some words, you know?
Yeah.
And where's the hope?
To be brief is not necessarily my thing, but one of the things that happened, the peace agreements were signed in 1996, during that period, because the constitution we actually have now in Guatemala was written in 85, if I'm not wrong, and that was like the beginning of a process of transition that has like this hallmark in 96 when the peace agreements were signed. And one of the things that happened is that a lot of these parallel power and violent structures that were predominant in the 1980s evolved and readapted into the new reality, because in the 1980s they had like the protection of impunity, the state impunity, because they were running the state. And then during the transition to democracy, and we started to have civilian governments, the thing is that a lot of them went into the background of what was happening in Guatemalan politics, even though they had a lot of influence everywhere. So they started to believe or to feel that they were under attack, I will say probably in the late 2000s, probably the peak of it was 2013, May 10th, when it was the sentence against Rios Montt, that he was found guilty of committing crimes against humanity and genocide. So they believed at that point, and because they wrote about that in national media, they say, okay, this is like an act of treason, they say, because we signed the peace agreements. And what the guerrilleros, because they believed that the human rights activists were actually guerrilleros, and most of them didn't have anything to do. Some of them, yes, but not everybody. But they say, okay, the guerrilleros, treason, the spirit of the peace agreements, because they are bringing now the war into the courts. That was like their discourse. So they were like making a claim that there was some sort of lawfare in the moment because of the human right cases. But yet, as Giovanni said, these were cases where 200, 250,000 people were killed in the country, and you had like communities that were completely disappeared. I mean, you had like a lot of massacres. I don't remember the number of massacres that happened in 82, for instance, but are more than 600, if I am not remembering wrong. So it was like a period of a lot of violence. None of these crimes were protected under the amnesty laws, international laws. So all of these laws of crimes had to be prosecuted. The thing was that was like a very important moment for them, because they like shifted, they started to come out and became like more vocal, you know. And one of the things that increased, this reaction happened with, because we had a lot of problems with corruption in Guatemala. In early 2010s, they created this thing that was called the Comisión contra la Impunidad en Guatemala, Comisión Internacional contra la Impunidad en Guatemala, CICIG, the International Commission Against Impunity in Guatemala. And they didn't a lot of work for a long time, but it was until 2015 that there was this big case where they uncover the corruptions, corruption that was taking place in the aduanas, ¿cómo era? Aduanas. Yeah, in customs, you know, but like they found that everybody was implied in that thing, and there were thousands of millions of dollars that were being stolen from practically Guatemalan taxes, or taxes that weren't paid, and that had eventually two effects. One, there was an increase in activism. From 2015 until 2018, more or less, we had a lot of massive protests. We had sometimes 150,000 people gathered in protest against corruption and everything. But the thing was that every week a new case came out, and a new case, and a new case. And suddenly it was not only the former military, but also the people from this unions of entrepreneurs, you know, the owners of fincas and factories and everything. They have these chambers, and they have a lot of power in Guatemala. So suddenly some of them started to appear, for instance, in corruption cases in the construction of infrastructure, roads, and everything. So they got scared. And what happened is that they created like a united front. And in 2018, the president that was elected was also like part of that kind of recomposition of power. And they expelled the commission. And they took over the public attorney office, which is, we have like this Ministerio Público is the name of it. It's like the public attorney office. And after that, everything was, really bad, because what they did is that they actually started to use the justice system to get vengeance against activists who were like very visible in those prior years, and also against actors from the judicial system that were very relevant. So that happened during those years. And one of the things that also happened is that for this election that took place a couple of months ago, they were like trying to avoid that everybody who could have the chance to get into the, because we have two rounds. It's the first round, then we get two candidates, and then we have the second round. So they were secure that one of the candidates that they allowed to participate, that he was not going to have any chance, but they expelled everybody else. Even Thelma Cabrera was here. She was the representative of the Movimiento de la Liberación de los Pueblos. But what they created was actually the conditions, because people, it was really, really not wanting to vote for anybody from this gang any longer. And everybody ended up voting for this other option, which is a central democratic option, but they see them as the incarnation of international Soviet communism, revived in Guatemala. So what we're having now, this protest, is because they are trying to find a way to avoid this elected president to take power now in January. So that is what's happening now in the country, and this is why a lot of people are scared. A lot of people is actually in exile, and
There's a lot going on in Guatemala, and again, I think, at least on this campus, that's why we're trying to push for Central American Studies, you know what I'm saying? To kind of have more visibility and representation, because again, this conversation could go on and on and on. We did have Thelma Cabrera do a virtual forum a couple of months ago, so that was awesome. And then just the Issue University, which was mentioned various times before we opened it up to Q&A. This is kind of like a grassroots decolonizing indigenous university in Guatemala. And in the winter quarter, sorry, I'm going to plug in my classroom, we're going to have like a virtual class with the Issue University, right? So we're hoping to kind of continue to create collaborative efforts with indigenous universities such as the Issue University, right? So I'll be teaching that in the winter. So come talk to me if y'all are interested in that. So sorry, cheap plug. Well, with that in mind, thank you, Alejandro, again for this information. So we're going to open it up for maybe two or three questions from the audience.
I'm really interested in the way that you are discussing and allowing and giving space for people to talk about their childhood within your film. Estoy muy interesada, especialmente porque para mí el café es fresa en Salinas. Yo trabajé en el field de fresa. Cuando José, mi mayordomo, me tiró mi caja de fresa y en la y me dijo que la recogiera, yo nomás me fui. I was like, I'm not doing that, get somebody else to do it. They pay me by the box, not the hour. My childlike self thought that revolution was to eat the strawberry, because I was the gatekeeper between the grocery store and the field and the best picked strawberries. And I want to know if you're going to explore child defiance and imagination, maybe the way that they're expressing defiance through play with toys. I'm interested in that and how you're exploring that, if it's going to be something that's explored.
what I have planned is that I'm going to write eventually a book, which is going to be kind of a fictionalized book, but with like a real life quotes. And the idea is to explore the, I mean, for instance, these kinds of things you're talking about, because there is a case that came out in the book, for instance, which is really, really sad. It's about a girl who, all what she wanted was a pair of shoes, you know? But his father was so poor, he couldn't afford, and he didn't, I mean, for instance, in those cases where they could sell, like, for instance, the cattle or something to buy clothes, he didn't have that possibility. So what he did once is that they went to Nevaj, and he went to the basurero, to the place where all the rubbish was, and he could find only one shoe. And he gave that single shoe to her, and she was like, okay, this is all what can I get? But it's I don't know, it's a very strong experience, but she sees, for instance, in that moment when she sees that she cannot get a shoe or a pair of shoes, as something that later in her life moves her into rising up in arms. So that's these are the kinds of stories that that of course are very relevant to work more. But yeah, for film production and editing and everything, it's always like like a challenge, you know. What do you show on? I mean, how can you make things not become so extensive? So I think that's going to appear eventually in the book I'm preparing.
Muchas gracias. My question is about you mentioned the extractivismo académico. And I want to ask you what about the current narratives about the Ishil people? Like, what kind of, because they mention about, they tell us that everybody is guerrillero, comunista, but right now what are these narratives about them, like all these elites or human rights or about the people? Thank you.
I mean, you are thinking at like an hegemonic national level. Yeah, I mean, the thing is that there are, I will say, split, because the genocide trial created like a different form of consciousness, I believe, among certain groups. But I will say that, like, the most general consensus is very traditional, you know, in the fashion that Guatemala is still a post-colonial reality, and that means that the national imagination, the national discourse, the national representation of indigenous peoples very often is filtered through the, for instance, the idea of tourism. You know, I mean, if you see the Ministry of Tourism in Guatemala, it's always, I mean, portraying, I mean, or they always create this very ridiculous like stance where they have a white woman wearing indigenous clothes, for instance, or things that happens very often, and also with the Ishilis. That's one part. But on the other part, I will say that for the former military, I mean, people who took part in the counterinsurgency process, they still see a lot of Ishilis as subversive. However, what you are going to see in the Ishil region is also that there is not only like one monolithic idea, I mean, politically speaking, of the Ishilis. There are a lot of differences. I mean, Ishilis are very plural politically. Of course, I mean, the people we're working with is like people engaging in community process, ancestral authorities. They tend to be kind of open-minded with some social aspects. But then you can find, another person who is super reactionary, super conservative, and sometimes you can see that difference happening in one single family. I mean, you can have a brother who was a guerrilla combatant, and you can have another brother or sister or brother who was a military combatant or patrulla de autodefensa civil. The thing is that all these realities, as you always say, are messy, you know? There is no black and white here. Never, 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 you know? So it's like a good thing to think about these kinds of work is that these are partial works. It's not necessarily like the traditional idea of probably early 20th century ethnography that you are making a picture of the real, you know, like almost in Lacanian terms, you know, like, I mean, for us it's inaccessible, but the real is there and you have the ethnography that tells you the truth. La neta, dicen los mexicanos, yeah? And that has never been like that. There are always differences within indigenous communities. So this is very important to highlight as well. So I think it's very important your question, because you're going to see that people, I mean, all around the country has differences. This is why also, I mean, what Gio was saying is very important. Paying always attention to nuances, trying to avoid like this very easy black and white, who's the good guy, who's the bad guy narratives, because it's, I mean, nobody's good, nobody's, you know, bad, I mean, completely. You're going to find people that were probably forced to take part in the military or in the patrullas, autodefensa civil, and they are super cool people now, like working with ancestral authorities and pushing like anti-extractivist like resistance. Gio has done research in that direction. Mm-hmm. So it's always good to have an open mind, because otherwise it can happen also that we become with this idea, okay, where I'm going to find the bad guy, and I mean if we are looking specifically for the bad guy, probably we're going to find somebody, and we are going to extract. I mean, we're going to work with that logic, okay, we're going to come here and show, hey, this is the bad guy, this is the good guy, and it can perpetuate precisely the logic of epistemic and social extractivism in this community. So I think one of the best things that we all can do, and this is why the question about positionality was asking, Johnny was asking in the beginning, is very important, because you see that, for instance, what we're seeing here, I mean, this film is specifically about positionality. It's not necessarily about my positionality. It's about the positionality of people who rose up in arms. And there were indigenous peoples. They were Ixiles. And the thing is that not everybody rose up in arms, even though there were a lot of them that did it. But what is important is to understand the differences, even though that was like the outcome at that precise moment in history. So that's, I don't know, probably that's what I would say in the question you're asking.
If we could just close out the evening with a last round of applause for him and for all of you.
Gracias.
Thanks a lot. Thank you.
Thank you. You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.